brother. "You must be decently modest in her eyes," the white-haired maiden told him, "but not so modest she thinks you boring. Ask her to scrape your back in the sweat-tent, but shyly, with your eyes downcast. When you undress for bed, let yourself dance, as if life pleases you. Then apologize when you suddenly realize she is there, and put yourself straight into your blankets. Can you blush?" A great deal of suffering in silence. The maidens knew too much and not enough. When they returned to Camelin, well after the sun had gone down, Rand crept into his apartment with his boots in his hands, fumbling his way through the anteroom into his bedchamber in the dark. Even if he had not known Avienda would be there, already on her pallet on the floor by the wall, he would have felt her presence. In the stillness of the night, he could hear her breathing. For once, it seemed, he had managed to wait long enough for her to fall asleep. He had tried to stop this, but Avienda paid him no mind, and the maidens laughed at his shyness and modesty. Good things in a man when alone, they agreed, so long as not carried too far. He climbed into his bed with a sense of relief that Avienda was already asleep, and some disgruntlement that he dared not light a lamp to wash. And she turned over on her pallet. Very likely she had been awake all along. "Sleep well and wake," was all she said. Thinking what idiocy it was to feel this sudden contentment because a woman he wanted to avoid told him good night, he stuffed a goose-down pillow beneath his head. Avienda probably thought this the most marvelous joke. Taunting was almost an art among Aiel, and the nearer it came to bringing blood, the better. Sleep began to come, and his last conscious thought was that he had a huge joke of his own, though only he and Matt and Bashir knew it yet. Samael had no sense of humor at all, but that great hammer of an army waiting in Tyr was the biggest joke the world had ever seen. With any luck, Samael would be dead before he knew he should laugh. Chapter 5. A Different Dance. The Golden Stag lived up to its name in most ways. Polished tables and benches, with rose-carved legs, dotted the large common room. One white-aproned serving girl did nothing but sweep the white stone floor. Blue and gold scrollwork made a broad painted band on the plaster walls just below the high-beamed ceiling. The fireplaces were well-dressed stone, their hearths decorated with a few evergreen branches, and a stag chiseled above each lintel supporting a wine cup in branching antlers. A tall clock with a little gilding stood on one mantel. A knot of musicians played on a small dais at the back. Two perspiring men in their shirt sleeves with keening flutes, a pair plucking nine-string bitterns, and a red-faced woman in a blue-striped dress working tiny wooden hammers across a dulcimer on thin legs. More than a dozen serving maids scurried in and out, stepping quickly in their aprons and pale blue dresses. Most were pretty, though some carried nearly as many years as Mistress Dalvin, the round little innkeeper with her wispy gray bun at the nape of her neck. Just the sort of place Matt liked. It fairly oozed comfort and an air of money. He had chosen it because it sat nearly dead center in the town, but the other had not hurt. Not everything fitted the second-best inn in Mehrone, of course. The smells from the kitchen were mutton and turnips again, and the inevitable spicy barley soup, and they mingled with the smell of dust and horses from outside. Well, food was a problem in a town jammed with refugees and soldiers, and more in camps all around it. Men's voices singing raucous marching songs came and went in the street, the sounds of boots and horses' hooves, and men cursing the heat. The common room was hot, too, without a breath of air stirring. Had the windows been swung out, dust would soon have coated everything inside, and it still would not have done much for the heat inside. Mehrone was a griddle. As far as Matt could see, the whole bloody world was drying up, and he did not want to think about why. He wished he could forget the heat, forget why he was in Mehrone, forget everything. His good green coat, gold embroidered on collar and cuffs, was undone, his fine linen shirt unlaced, yet he still sweated like a horse. It might have helped to remove the black silk scarf looped around his neck, but he seldom did where anyone could see. Draining the last of his wine, he set the burnished pewter cup on the table at his elbow and picked up his broad-brimmed hat to fan himself. Whatever he drank no sooner went in than he sweated it out. When he chose to stay at the Golden Stag, the lords and officers of the Band of the Red Hand followed his lead, which meant all others stayed clear. That usually did not displease Mistress Dalvin. She could have rented out every bed 5 times over just among the lords and lordlings of the band, and that sort paid well, had few fights, and usually took them outside before spilling blood. This midday, however, only 9 or 10 men occupied the tables, and she occasionally blinked at the empty benches, patted at her bun, and sighed. She would not sell much wine before evening. A large part of her profits came from wine. The musicians played vigorously, though. A handful of lords pleased with the music. Anyone with gold deserved him a lord, so far as they were concerned. Could be more generous than a roomful of common soldiers. Unfortunately for the musicians' purses, Matt was the only man listening, and he winced at every third note. It really was not their fault. The music sounded fine, if you did not know what you were listening to. Matt did. He had taught it to them, clapping the beat and humming. But no one else had heard that tune in more than 2,000 years. The best to be said was that they had the rhythms right. A bit of conversation caught his ear. Tossing his hat down, he waved his cup to signal for more wine and leaned across his table toward the 3 men drinking around the next. "What was that?" "We are trying to figure out how to win some of our money back from you," Tamana said, unsmiling over his wine cup. He was not upset. Only a few years older than Matt's 20, and a head shorter, Talmanis seldom smiled. The man always made Matt think of a compressed spring. "No one can beat you at cards." The commander of half of the band's cavalry, he was a lord here in Kyrian, but the front of his head was shaved and powdered, though sweat had washed some of it away. A good many younger Kyrenian lords had taken up soldiers' styles. Talmanis's coat was plain, too, without a nobleman's slashes of color, although he was entitled to quite a few. "Not so," Matt protested. True, when his luck was in, it was perfect, but it ran in cycles, especially with things that had as much order as a deck of cards. "Blood and ashes, you won 50 crowns from me last week." 50 crowns. A year or so ago, he would have turned backflips at winning 1 crown, and wept at the thought of losing one. A year or so ago, he had not had one to lose. "How many 100 behind does that leave me?" Tomanus asked dryly. "I want a chance to win some back." If he ever did start winning against Matt with any consistency, he would start worrying, too. Like most of the band, he took Matt's luck as a talisman. "Dice are no bloody good," Darid said. Commander of the band's foot, he drank thirstily and ignored a grimace only half-hidden behind Elysian's oiled beard. Most nobles Matt had met thought dice common, fit only for peasants. "I've never seen you end the day behind a dice. It has to be something you have no control over, no hand in, if you understand." Just a little taller than his fellow Kyrenian Talmanis, Darid was a good 15 years older, his nose broken more than once, and 3 white scars crisscrossing his face. The only one of the 3 not nobly born, he wore the front of his head shaved and powdered, too. Darid had been a soldier all his life. "We thought horses," Nalesian put in, gesturing with his pewter mug. A blocky man, taller than either of the Kyrenian, he led the other half of the cavalry in the band. Given the heat, Matt often wondered why he kept his luxuriant black beard, but he trimmed it every morning to keep the point sharp. And where Darid and Talmanis wore their plain gray coats hanging open, Nalesian had his, green silk with those padded Tyran sleeves, striped and cuffed in gold satin, buttoned to the neck. His face glistened with sweat that he ignored. "Burn my soul, but your luck holds hard with battle and cards." "And dice," he added with another grimace at Darid. "But in horse racing, it's all the horse." Matt smiled and propped his elbows on the table. "Find yourself a good horse and we'll see." His luck might not affect a horse race. Aside from dice and cards and the like, he could never be sure what it would touch or when. But he had grown up watching his father trade horse flesh, and his own eye for a horse was fairly sharp.
"Do you want this wine or not? I cannot pour it if I cannot reach your cup."
Matt glanced over his shoulder. The serving maid behind him, with a polished pewter pitcher, was short and slim, a dark-eyed, pale-cheeked beauty with black curls nestling on her shoulders. And that precise, musical Kyrenian accent made her voice into chimes. He had had his eye on Betsy Sylvan since the first day he walked into the Golden Stag, but this was his first chance to speak to her. There were always 5 things that needed doing immediately, and 10 that should have been done yesterday. The other men had already buried their faces in their wine, leaving him as alone with the woman as they could without walking out. They had manners, even the 2 nobles. Grinning, Matt swung his legs over the bench and held out his cup for her to fill.
"Thank you, Betsy," he said, and she bobbed a curtsy.
When he asked her to pour one for herself and join him, however, she set the pitcher on the table, folded her arms, and tilted her head to one side, eyeing him up and down.
"I hardly think Mistress Dalvin would like that."
"Oh, no, I do not think she would."
"Are you a lord?
They all seem to jump for you, but no one calls you my lord."
"They barely even bow, just the commoners."
Matt's eyebrows shot up.
"No," he said, more curtly than he wished, "I am not a lord."
Rand could let people run around calling him Lord Dragon and the like, but that was not for Matrim Cawthon. No, indeed. Taking a deep breath, he put his grin back on. Some women tried to nudge a man off balance, but it was a dance he was good at.
"Just call me Matt, Betsy. I'm sure Mistress Dalvin won't mind if you just sit with me." "Oh, yes, she would. But I suppose I can talk a bit. You must be almost a lord. Why are you wearing that in this heat?"
Leaning forward, she pushed his scarf down with a finger. He had not been paying attention, and had let it slip a little.
"What is this?"
She ran her finger along the pale, thickened ridge that circled his neck.
"Did someone try to hang you? Why? You are too young to be a hardened scofflaw."
He pulled his head back and hastily retied the black silk to hide his scar, but Betsy was not put off. Her hand dipped into the unlaced front of his shirt to pull up the silver foxhead medallion he wore in a leather thong.
"Was it for stealing this? It looks valuable. Is it valuable?"
Matt snatched the medallion away, stuffed it back where it belonged. The woman hardly drew breath, certainly not enough for him to get a word in. He heard Nalisian and Darid chuckling behind him, and his face darkened. Sometimes his luck with gambling was stood on its head with women, and they always found it funny.
"No, they would not have let you keep it if you stole it, would they?" Betsy chattered on. "And if you are almost a lord, I suppose you can own things like that. Perhaps it was because you knew too much. You look a young man who knows a great deal, or thinks he does."
She smiled one of those shrewd little smiles that women wore when they wanted to fuddle a man. It seldom meant they knew anything, but they could make you think they did.
"Did they try to hang you for thinking you knew too much? Or was it for pretending to be a lord? Are you sure you are not a lord?"
Darid and Nalisian were laughing right out now, and even Talmanis was chuckling, though they tried to pretend it was about something else. Darid wheezingly interjected some tale about a man falling off a horse whenever he had breath enough, but there was nothing funny in the bits Matt heard. He kept his grin on, though. He was not going to be routed, even if she could talk faster than he could run. She was very pretty, and he had spent the last few weeks talking to the likes of Darid and worse, sweaty men who sometimes forgot to shave and too often had no chance to bathe. Perspiration beaded Betsy's cheeks, but she gave off a faint smell of lavender-scented soap.
"Actually, I got that scratch for knowing too little," he said lightly.
Women always liked it when you played down your scars. The light knew he was growing enough of them.
"I know too much now, but too little then. You could say I was hanged for knowledge."
Shaking her head, Betsy pursed her lips.
"That sounds like it is supposed to be witty, Matt. Lordlings say witty things all the time, but you say you are not a lord. Besides, I'm a simple woman. Wit goes right over my head. I think simple words are best. Since you are not a lord, you should speak simply, or else some might think you were playing at being a lord. No woman likes a man pretending to be what he is not. Maybe you could explain what you were trying to say. Maintaining his smile was an effort. Bandying words with her was not going at all the way he wanted. He could not tell whether she was a complete nit or just managing to make him trip over his ears, trying to keep up. Either way, she was still pretty, and she still smelled of lavender, not sweat. Darrett and Elysian seemed to be choking to death. Tamanis was humming "A Frog on the Ice." So he was skidding about with his feet in the air, was he? Matt put down his wine cup and rose, bowing over Betsy's hand. I am who I am, and no more, but your face drives words right out of my head. That made her blink. Whatever they said, women always like flowery talk. Will you dance? Not waiting for an answer, he led her toward where a clear floor stretched the length of the common room, through the tables. With luck, dancing would slow her tongue a little, and he was lucky, after all. Besides, he had never heard of a woman whose heart was not softened by dancing. Dance with her, and she will forgive much. Dance well, and she will forgive anything. That was a very old saying. Very old. Betsy hung back, biting her lip and looking for Mistress Dalvin. But the plump little innkeeper only smiled and waved Betsy on, then patted ineffectually at the tendrils escaping her bun and went back to chivying the other serving maids as though the tables were full. Mistress Dalvin would have been all over any man she thought was behaving improperly. Despite her placid appearance, she kept a short cudgel in her skirts and sometimes used it. Elysian still eyed her carefully when she came close. But if a free-spending man wanted a dance, what was the harm in that? He held Betsy's hands outstretched to either side. There should be just enough room between the tables. The musicians began to play louder, if no better. Follow me, he told her. The steps are simple to start. In time to the music, he began. Dip and a gliding sidestep to the right, left foot sliding after. Dip and a gliding step and slide, with arms outstretched. Betsy caught on quickly, and she was light on her feet. When they reached the musicians, he smoothly lifted her hands overhead and spun himself and her back to back. Then it was dip and sidestep, twirl, face to face, dip, sidestep and twirl, again and again, all the way back to where they began. She fell into that just as swiftly, smiling up at him in delight whenever the turns allowed. She truly was pretty. A little more complicated now, he murmured, turning so they faced the musicians side by side, wrists crossed and hands linked in front of them. Right knee up, slight kick left, then glide forward and right. Left knee up, slight kick right, then glide forward and left. Betsy laughed as they wove their way to the performers once more. The steps became more intricate with each passage, but she needed only one demonstration to match him, light as a feather in his hands with each twist and turn and spin. Best of all, she did not say a word. The music caught him up, missed notes and all, and the pattern dance, and memories floated in his head as they floated back and forth across the floor. In memory, he was a head taller, with long golden mustaches and blue eyes. He wore a red-sashed coat of amber silk with a ruff of finest barcine lace and yellow sapphire studs from Aramail on his chest, and he danced with a darkly beautiful emissary of the Athaan Mier, the sea folk. The fine gold chain linking her nose ring to one of her multitude of earrings held tiny medallions that identified her as Wave Mistress of Clan Shodin. He did not care how powerful she was. That was for the king to worry over, not a middling lord. She was beautiful and light in his arms, and they danced beneath the great crystal dome at the court of Shemal, when all the world envied Coromanda's splendor and might. Other memories flitted around the edges, sparking off bits of that remembered dance. The morrow would bring news of increasingly heavy Trolloc raids out of the Great Blight, and another month, word that Barsine of the Golden Spires had been ravaged and burned, and the Trolloc hordes were sweeping south. So would begin what later would be called the Trolloc Wars, though none gave it that name to begin. 300 years and more of all but unbroken battle, blood, fire, and ruin, before the Trollocs were driven back, the Dreadlords hunted down. So would begin the fall of Coromanda, with all its wealth and power, and Asenia, with its philosophers and famed seats of learning, of Menetherin and Aharon, and all of the 10 nations, smashed even in victory to rubble, from which other lands would rise, lands that barely remembered the 10 nations as more than myths of a happier time. But that lay ahead, and he banished those memories in the pleasure of this one. Tonight, he danced the pattern dance with... He blinked, for an instant startled by sunlight streaming through the windows and the fair face beaming up at him through a sheen of perspiration. Very nearly, he fumbled the complex interweaving of his feet with Betsy's as they whirled down the floor, but he caught himself before tripping her, the steps coming instinctively. This dance was his as surely as those memories were, borrowed or stolen, but so seamlessly woven into those he really had lived that he could no longer tell the difference without thinking. All his, now, filling holes in his own memories. He might as well have lived them all. It had been true what he told her about the scar on his neck, hanged for knowledge and for lack of it. Twice he had stepped through a Tirangrial like a bull-goose fool, a country idiot thinking it simple as a walk across the meadow. Well, almost as simple. The results only hardened his mistrust of anything to do with the One Power. The first time he had been told he was fated to die and live again, among other things he did not want to hear. Some of those other things had set him on the path to his second journey through a Tirangrial, and that had led him to having a rope tied around his neck. A series of steps, each taken for good cause or pure necessity, each seeming so reasonable at the time, and each leading to things he had never imagined. He always seemed to find himself caught in that sort of dance. He had been dead for sure until Rand cut him down and revived him. For the 100th time, he had remade a promise to himself. From now on, he was going to watch where he put his feet, no more jumping into things without thinking what might come of it. In truth, he had gained more than the scar that day. The silver fox head, for one, its single eye shaded to look like the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai. Sometimes he laughed so hard over that medallion that his ribs hurt. He did not trust any Aes Sedai, so he even bathed and slept with the thing around his neck. The world was a funny place. Funny peculiar, usually. Another gain really had been knowledge, if unwanted knowledge. Slices of other men's lives packed his head now. Thousands of them, sometimes only a few hours, sometimes years altogether, though in patches. Memories of courts and combats stretching for well over 1,000 years, from long before the Trolloc Wars to the final battle of Arthur Hawkwing's rise. All his now, or they might as well be. Nalisian and Darrett and Talmanas were clapping to the music, and the other men scattered around the tables too. Men of the Band of the Red Hand urging their commander on in his dance. Light, but that name made Matt cringe inside. It had belonged to a legendary band of heroes who died trying to save Menetherin. Not a man who rode or marched behind the band's banner, but thought they would end up in the legends, too. Mistress Delvin was clapping as well, and the rest of the maids had stopped to watch. Those other men's memories were why the band followed Matt, though they did not know. Because his head held memories of more battles and campaigns than 100 men could have faced. Whether he had been on the winning side or the losing, he remembered how those battles were won or lost, and it took only a little wit to translate that into winning for the band. So far it had, at least. When he could find no way to avoid the fighting. More than once he had wished those bits of other men were out of his head. Without them, he would not be where he was, commanding nearly 6,000 soldiers, and more wanting to join every day, about to lead them south and take command of the bloody invasion of a land controlled by one of the bloody Forsaken. He was no hero, and did not want to be one. Heroes had a bad habit of getting killed. When you were a hero, it was toss the dog a bone and shove him into a corner out of the way, unless it was promise the dog a bone and send him out to hunt again. The same for soldiers, for that matter. On the other hand, without those memories, he would not have 6,000 soldiers around him. He would stand alone, to Viren and tied to the Dragon Reborn, a naked target unknown to the Forsaken. Some of them apparently knew entirely too much about Matt Cawthon. Moraine had claimed he was important, that maybe Rand needed him and Perrin both to win the last battle. If she had been right, he would do what he had to. He would. He just had to get used to the idea. But he was not about to be a bloody hero. If he could just figure out what to do about the bloody Horn of Valyr. Offering up a small prayer for Moraine's soul, he hoped she had been wrong. He and Betsy reached the end of the clear space for the final time, and she collapsed against his chest, laughing when he stopped.
"Oh, that was wonderful. I felt like I was in a royal palace somewhere. Can we do it again? Oh, can we? Can we?"
Mistress Delvin applauded for a moment, then realized the other serving maids were standing about and rounded on them, sending them scurrying like chickens with vigorous waves of her arms.
"Does Daughter of the Nine Moons mean anything to you?"
The words just popped out. It was thinking about those Tirangrial that did it. Wherever he found the Daughter of the Nine Moons, "Please, light, let it be a long time yet," it was a fervent thought. Wherever he found her, it would not be serving table at a small town inn crammed full of soldiers and refugees. Then again, who could say when it came to prophecy? It had been prophecy, in a way. To die and live again. To marry the Daughter of the Nine Moons. To give up half the light of the world. To save the world. Whatever that meant. He had died, after all, swinging on that rope. If that was true, the rest had to be. No way out of that.
"Daughter of the Nine Moons," Betsy said breathlessly. Lack of breath did not slow her down. "Is it an inn? A tavern?" "Not here in Meyrone, I know that. Maybe across the river in Arangil? I have never been to—"
Matt laid a finger across her lips. "It doesn't matter. Let's dance another dance." A country dance this time, something from the here and now, with no memories but his attached to it. Only, he really did have to think to tell them apart now. A throat clearing made him glance over his shoulder, and he sighed at the sight of a Dorian, standing in the doorway, steel-backed gauntlets tucked behind his sword belt and helmet beneath his arm. The young Tyran Lord had been a plump, pink-cheeked man when Matt gambled with him in the Stone of Tyr, but he had grown harder and sun-dark since coming north. The rimmed helmet bore no plumes now, and chips and dents marred the once ornate gilding on his breastplate. His puffy-sleeved coat was blue-striped with black, but showing wear.
"You told me to remind you of your rounds at this hour."
A Dorian coughed into his fist. He ostentatiously did not glance at Betsy.
"But I could come back later, if you wish." "I'll come now," Matt told him.
It was important to make rounds every day, inspect something different every day. Those other men's memories told him that, and he had come to trust them about things like this. If he was stuck in this job, he might as well try to do it right. Doing it right might keep him alive. Besides, Betsy had drawn away from him and was trying to pat sweat from her face with her apron and straighten her hair at the same time. The euphoria was fading from her face. It did not matter. She would remember.
"Dance well with a woman," he thought smugly, "and she's halfway yours."
"Give these to the musicians," he told her, folding 3 gold marks into her hand. However badly they had played, for a time the tune had taken him away from Meyrone and the immediate future. Anyway, women liked generosity. This was going very well. With a bow, just short of kissing her hand, he added, "Until later, Betsy. We'll dance again when I come back." To his surprise, she waggled a finger under his nose and gave an admonitory shake of her head, as if she had read his mind. Well, he had never claimed to understand women. Settling his hat on his head, he took up his black-hafted spear from beside the door. That was another gift from the other side of that Tirangrial, with its inscription of the shaft in the old tongue, and its odd head like a short sword blade marked with 2 ravens. "We'll do the drinking rooms today," he told the Dorian, and they strode out into the full heat of midday, into the bedlam of Meyrone. It was a small, unwalled town, though 50 times larger than anything he had seen before leaving the 2 rivers. An overgrown village, really. Few of the brick and stone buildings were more than a single story high, and only the inns, rising as much as 3, with as many roofs of wooden shingles or thatch as slate or tile.
Now the streets, most hard-packed dirt, were thronged with people. The townsfolk were of every sort, mainly Kyrenian and Andorans. Although it lay on the Kyrenian side of the Erinin, Meyrone was in no nation now, but balanced between, with folk from half a dozen lands living there or passing through. There had even been three or four Aes Sedai since Matt arrived. Even wearing the medallion, he walked wide of them. No need to seek out trouble. But they all moved on as quickly as they came. His luck did run good when it was important. So far it had. The townspeople hurried about their business, for the most part ignoring the many ragged men, women, and children who wandered about blankly. All Kyrenian, those last usually found their way down to the river before returning to the refugee camps ringing the town. Few left to go home, though. The civil war might be over up in Kyrian, but there were still brigands, and they feared the Aiel. For all Matt knew, they feared running into the Dragon Reborn. The simple truth of it was, they had run as far as they could. None had energy remaining for much beyond those trips to the river to stare at Andor. The band's soldiers added to the crowds, ones or threes meandering about the shops and taverns, troops in formation, crossbowmen and archers in jerkins covered with steel discs, pikemen in battered breastplates cast off by their betters or looted from the dead. Everywhere rode breastplated horsemen, Tyran lancers in rimmed helmets, and Kyrianen in bell-shaped helmets, even some Andorans in conical helmets with barred face guards. Ravin had tossed a good many men out of the Queen's Guards, men too loyal to Morghais, and some had joined the band. Hawkers moved through the mass with their trays, crying needles and thread, ointments claimed to be good for any wound, and remedies for everything from blisters to watery bowels to camp fever. Soap, tin pots and cups guaranteed not to rust out, woolen stockings, knives and daggers of the finest Andorran steel, the seller's word on it, every sort of thing that a soldier might need, or the vendors thought he might be convinced he did. The din was such that any hawker's bellows were swallowed up 3 paces away. The soldiers recognized Matt right away, of course, and many raised cheers, even men too far away to see more than his broad-brimmed hat and odd spear. Those picked him out as clearly as any noble's sigil. He had heard all the rumors about why he disdained armor and helmet. There were all sorts, from mad bravery to the claim that only a weapon forged by the Dark One himself could kill him. Some said the hat had been given him by Aes Sedai, and as long as he wore it, nothing could kill him. The fact was, it was an ordinary hat, and he wore it because it gave good shade, and because it was a good reminder to stay clear of anywhere he might need helmet and armor. The tales circulating about his spear, with that inscription that few even among the nobles could read, were more extravagant still. None could match the truth, though. That raven-marked blade had been made by Aes Sedai during the War of the Shadow, before the breaking. It never needed sharpening, and he doubted he could break it if he tried. Waving to acknowledge shouts of "The Light Illumine, Lord Matrim," and "Lord Matrim in victory," and such drivel, he made his way through the crowds with a Dorian. At least he did not have to push. They gave way as soon as they saw him. He wished so many of the refugees did not stare as though he had the key to their hopes hidden in his pocket. Aside from making sure they got food from the wagon trains coming up from Tyr, he did not know what he could do. A good many were dirty as well as ragged. "Did the soap get out to the camps?" he muttered. A Dorian heard despite the uproar. "It did. Most trade it back to the peddlers for cheap wine. They don't want soap. They want to cross the river, or else drown their miseries." Matt grunted sourly. Passage to Arengil was one thing he could not give them. Until civil war and worse tore Kyrian apart, Meyrone had been a transit point for trade between Kyrian and Tyr, which meant it had almost as many inns and taverns as it did houses. The first 5 he poked his nose into varied little, from the Fox and the Goose to the Wagoner's Whip. Stone buildings with packed tables and the occasional budding fist fight, which Matt ignored. No one was drunk, though. The river gate, all the way across town, had been Meyrone's best inn, but heavy planks nailed across its sun-carved doors served as a reminder to the innkeepers and tapsters not to get the band's soldiers drunk. Still, even sober soldiers fought, Tyran against Kyrianen against Andoran, foot against horse, one lord's men against another's, veterans against new recruits, soldiers against civilians. Fights were quelled before they got out of hand, though, by soldiers carrying cudgels and wearing red armbands that stretched from wrist to elbow. Each unit had to take its turn providing red arms, different men every day, and the red arms had to pay for any damage the day they were on duty. It made them industrious in keeping the peace. At the Fox and Goose, a gleeman was juggling flaming batons, a stout man in his middle years, while another, a skinny, balding fellow at the Erinnan Inn, had his harp in hand and declaimed part of the Great Hunt of the Horn. Despite the heat, each wore his distinctive cloak, all covered with patches in 100 colors that fluttered when he moved. A gleeman would give up a hand before that cloak. They had fairly attentive audiences. Many of the onlookers came from villages that eagerly greeted a gleeman's visit, more so than the girl singing on a table in a tavern called the Three Towers. She was pretty enough, with her long, dark curls, but a song about true love was not likely to interest the raucously laughing men drinking there. The remaining places had no entertainment beyond a musician or two, yet the crowds were louder still, and dice games at half the tables made Matt's fingers twitch. But he really did almost always win, at least with dice, and it would not be right to take coin from his own soldiers. That was what most of the men at the tables were. Few refugees had coin to spend in common rooms. A handful of others dotted the members of the band. Here a lean, fork-bearded Kandori with a moonstone the size of his thumbnail in one earlobe and silver chains across the chest of his red coat. There a copper-skinned Domani woman, though wearing a modest blue dress, with eyes quick and gemmed rings on all her fingers. Elsewhere a Tarabonner, in a conical, flat-topped blue cap, thick mustache hidden behind a transparent veil. Plump men in Tyran coats, tight to the waist, or bony fellows in Mirandian coats, hanging to the knee. Sharp-eyed women in dresses, high-necked or ankle-length, but always in well-cut wool of sober color. Merchants all, ready to leap in when trade reopened between Andor and Kyrian. And in every common room, two or three men sat apart from the others, usually alone, for the most part hard-eyed fellows, some well-dressed, others little better garbed than the refugees, but every one looking as if he knew how to use the sword at his hip or on his back. Matt identified two women with that lot, though neither showed a weapon. One had a long walking staff propped against her table, and he supposed the other had knives hidden in her riding dress. He carried a few throwing knives tucked about his person, too. He was sure he knew what she and the others were about, and she was a fool if she went at it unarmed. As he and Dorian stepped out of the wagoner's whip, Matt stopped to watch a blocky woman in divided brown skirts wend her way through the crowds. Unblinking eyes that caught everything in the street belied the apparent placidity of her round face, and so did the studded cudgel at her belt, and a dagger heavy-bladed enough to do for an Aielman. So, a third woman in the lot. Hunters for the Horn was what they were, the legendary Horn of Valir, that would call dead heroes back from the grave to fight in the last battle. Whoever found it would earn a place in the histories. If there's anyone left to write a bloody history, Matt thought wryly. Some believe the Horn would turn up where there was turmoil and strife. 400 years since the Hunt of the Horn was last called, and this time people had all but dropped out of the trees to take the oaths. He had seen flocks of hunters in the streets of Kyrian, and he expected to see more flocks when he reached Tyr. Without doubt, they would be streaming toward Camelin now as well. He wished one of them had found the thing. To the best of his knowledge, the Horn of Bloody Valir lay somewhere deep in the White Tower. And if he knew anything about Aes Sedai, he would be surprised if a dozen of them were aware of it. A troop of foot behind a mounted officer in a dented breastplate and a Kyrenian helmet marched between him and the blocky woman. Close to 200 pikemen, weapons a tall forest of spikes, followed by 50 or more archers with quivers on hips and bows slung on shoulders. Not the Two Rivers longbow Matt had grown up with, but a fair enough weapon. He had to find enough crossbows to go around, though the archers were not willing to make the change.
They sang as they marched, the massed voices enough to punch through the rest of the noise. You'll feed on beans and on rotten hay, and a horse's hoof come your naming day. You'll sweat and bleed till you grow old, and your only gold will be dreams of gold. If you go to be a soldier, if you go to be a soldier. A fat knot of civilians trailed along behind, townsmen and refugees mingled, young men all, watching curiously and listening. It never ceased to amaze Matt. The worse the song made soldiering seem, this was far from the worst, the larger the crowd. Sure as water was wet, some of those men would be talking to a bannerman before the day was out, and most who did would sign their names or make their mark. They must think the song was an attempt to scare them off and keep the glory and loot. At least the Pikes were not singing Dance with Jack of the Shadows. Matt hated that song. Once the lads realized Jack of the Shadows was death, they started panting to find a bannerman. Your girl will marry another man, a muddy grave will be all your land. Food for the worms and none to mourn, you'll curse the day you were ever born. If you go to be a soldier, if you go to be a soldier. There's a good deal of wondering, Dorian said casually as the formation swung on down the street with its trail of idiots, about when we'll be heading south. There are rumors. He peered at Matt from the corner of his eye, measuring his mood. I noticed the farriers checking the teams for the supply wagons. We'll move when we move, Matt told him. No need to let Samael know we're coming. Dorian gave him a level look. This Tyran was no dunce. Not that Nalesian was. He was just over-eager sometimes. But Dorian had a sharp mind. Nalesian would never have noticed the farriers. Too bad that House Aldeia outranked House Salorna, where Matt would have had Dorian in Nalesian's place. Fool nobles and their fool fixation on rank. No, Dorian was no blockhead. He knew that as soon as the band moved south, word would speed ahead with the river traffic, and maybe by pigeon as well. Matt would not have placed a bet against spies in Mehrone if he had felt his luck strong enough to pound his skull apart. There's also a rumor the Lord Dragon was in town yesterday, Dorian said as softly as the street noise would allow. The biggest thing that happened yesterday, Matt said wryly, was I had my first bath in a week. Now come on. It's going to take half what daylight is left to finish this as it is. He would have given a pretty to find out how that rumor began. Only off by a half day, and there certainly had been no one to see. It had been the small hours of morning when a slash of light suddenly appeared in his room at the Golden Stag. He had thrown himself desperately across the four-posted bed, one boot on and one half off, pulling the knife he wore hanging between his shoulder blades, before he realized it was Rand, stepping out of one of those bloody holes in nothing, apparently from the palace in Camelin by the columns visible before the opening winked out. It was startling him coming in the middle of the night without any Aiel and popping right into Matt's room, which last still made the hair on Matt's neck stand up. That thing could have sliced him in two had he been standing in the wrong place. He did not like the One Power. The whole thing had been very strange. Make haste slowly, Matt, Rand said, striding up and down. He never looked in Matt's direction. Sweat slicked his face, and his jaw was tight. He has to see it coming. Everything depends on it. Seated on his bed, Matt jerked his boot the rest of the way off and dropped it on the scrap of rug Mistress Dalvin had given him. I know, he said sourly, pausing to rub an ankle he had cracked on a bedpost. I helped make the bloody plan, remember? How do you know you're in love with a woman, Matt? Rand did not stop his striding, and he dropped it in as if it fit with what he had been saying. Matt blinked. How in the pit of doom should I know? That's one snare I've never put a foot in. What brought that on? But Rand only moved his shoulders as though shrugging something off. I'll finish somehow, Matt. I promise that. I owe it to the dead. But where are the others? I need to finish them all. One at a time, though. He barely managed to keep the question out of that.
There was no telling what Rand might take into his head these days. "There are dragons sworn in Murindi, Matt. In Altara, too. Men sworn to me. Once Ilion is mine, Altara and Murindi will drop like ripe plums. I'll make contact with the dragon sworn in Taraban and in Arad Daman. And if the White Cloaks try to keep me out of Amadisia, I'll crush them. The Prophet has Geledon primed, and Amadisia almost, so I hear. Can you imagine Massima as the Prophet? Saldea will come to me. Bashir is sure of it. All the Borderlands will come. They have to. I'm going to do it, Matt. Every land united before the last battle. I'm going to do it!" Rand's voice had taken on a feverish tone. "Sure, Rand," Matt said slowly, depositing his other boot beside the first. "But one thing at a time, right?" "No man should have another man's voice in his head," Rand muttered, and Matt's hands froze in the act of tugging off a woolen stocking. Oddly, he found himself wondering whether the pair had another day's wear in them. Rand knew something of what had happened inside that Tirangriel in Rudion. Knew he had somehow gained knowledge of soldiering, anyway, but not the whole of it. Matt thought not the whole of it. Not about other men's memories. Rand did not seem to notice anything out of the ordinary. He just scrubbed fingers through his hair and went on. "He can be galled, Matt. Samael always thinks in straight lines. But is there any opening he can slip through? If there's any mistake, thousands will die. Tens of thousands. Hundreds will anyway. But I don't want it to be thousands." Matt grimaced so fiercely that a sweaty-faced hawker trying to sell him a dagger, the hilt half-covered in colorful glass gems, nearly dropped the thing, burying himself in the crowd. It had all been like that with Rand, bouncing from the invasion of Ilion to the Forsaken to women. Light. Rand was the one who always had the way with women, him and Perrin. From the last battle to the Maidens of the Spear to things Matt hardly understood, seldom listening to Matt's replies and sometimes not even waiting for them. Hearing Rand talk about Samael as if he knew the man was more than just disconcerting. He knew Rand would go mad eventually, but if madness was creeping in already... And what of the others? Those fools Rand was gathering who wanted to channel. And this fellow Taim, who already could. Rand had just dropped that in casually. Mazrim Taim, false bloody dragon, teaching Rand's bloody students, or whatever they were. When they all started going insane, Matt did not want to be within 1,000 miles. Only he had as much choice as a leaf in a whirlpool. He was Tavirin, but Rand was more so. Nothing in the prophecies of the dragon about Matt Cawthon, but he was caught a shoat under a fence. Light, but he wished he had never seen the Horn of Valier. It was with a grim face that he stalked through the next dozen taverns and common rooms, circling out from the Golden Stag. They were really no different from the first, packed tables full of men drinking and dicing and arm-wrestling, musicians often as not drowned out by the uproar. Red arms quashing fights as soon as they began, a gleeman reciting the Great Hunt in one, that was popular even without hunters about. In another, a short, pale-haired woman, singing a slightly bawdy song, somehow made bawdier by her round face of wide-eyed innocence. His bleak mood held when he left the Silver Horn, idiotic name, and its innocent-faced singer. Maybe that was why he went running toward the shouting that erupted down the street in front of another inn. The Red Arms would take care of it if it involved soldiers, but Matt shoved his way through the crowd anyway. Rand going mad, leaving him hanging out in the storm, Taim and those other idiots ready to follow him into insanity, Samael waiting in Ilion, and the rest of the Forsaken, the Light knew where, all probably looking for a chance to take Matt Cawthon's head in passing. That did not even count what the Aes Sedai would do to him if they laid hands on him again, the ones who knew too much anyway. And everybody thinking he was going to go out and be a bloody hero. He usually tried to talk his way out of a fight if he could not walk wide of it, but right then he wanted an excuse to punch somebody in the nose. What he found was not anything he expected. A crowd of townspeople, short, drably clothed Kyrenian, and a sprinkling of taller Andrans in brighter colors, made an expressionless ring around two tall, lean men with curled mustaches, long Mirandian coats in bright silk, and swords with ornate gilded pommels and quillons. The fellow in a red coat stood grinning in amusement while he watched the one in yellow shake a boy little taller than Matt's waist by the collar like a dog shaking a rat. Matt held on to his temper. He reminded himself that he did not know what had started all this. "Easy with the boy," he said, laying a hand on Yellow Coat's arm. "What did he do to deserve—"
"He touched me horse!"
the man snapped in a Mindian accent, shaking off Matt's hand. Mindians boasted that they had the worst tempers of anyone in Murundi.
"I'll break his skinny peasant neck for him. I'll wring his scrawny."
Without another word, Matt brought the butt of his spear up hard, straight between the fellow's legs. The Mirandian's mouth opened, but no sound came out. His eyes rolled up till almost nothing showed but white. The boy darted off as the man's legs folded, depositing him on knees and face in the street.
"No, you won't," Matt said.
That was not the end of it, of course. The man in the red coat snatched at his sword. He managed to bare an inch of blade before Matt cracked his wrist with the spear butt. Grunting, he let go the sword hilt, but grabbed for the long-bladed dagger on his belt with his other hand. Hastily, Matt clipped him over the ear. Not hard, but the fellow went down atop the other man.
"Bloody fool!"
Matt was not sure whether he was describing Redcoat or himself. Half a dozen red arms had finally pushed through the onlookers, Tyran cavalrymen, awkward of foot in knee boots, their swollen black and gold sleeves crushed under the armbands. A Dorian had the boy in hand, a gaunt, sullen-looking lad of six or so, wriggling bare toes in the dust and now and again giving an experimental tug at a Dorian's grip. He was perhaps the ugliest child Matt had ever seen, with a squashed nose, a mouth too wide for his face, and ears too big that stuck out besides. By the holes in his coat and breeches, he was one of the refugees. He looked more dirt than anything else.
"Settle this out, Harnan," Matt said.
That was a lantern-jawed renarm, a file-leader with a long-suffering expression and a crude tattoo of a hawk on his left cheek. The fashion seemed to be spreading through the band, but most limited themselves to parts of the body normally covered.
"Find out what caused all this, then run these two louts out of town."
They deserved that much, whatever the provocation. A skinny man in a Mirandian coat of dark wool wiggled through the onlookers and dropped to his knees beside the pair on the ground. Yellowcoat had begun emitting strangled groans, and Redcoat was beginning to clutch his head in his hands and mumble what sounded like imprecations. The newcomer made more noise than both together.
"Oh, me lords! Me lord Pears! Me lord Coolin! Are ye killed?"
He stretched trembling hands toward Matt.
"Oh, don't kill them, my lord. Not helpless like this. They're hunters for the horn, my lord. I'm their man, Padre. Heroes they are, my lord."
"I'm not going to kill anybody," Matt cut in, disgusted.
"But you get these heroes on their horses and out of Mehrone by sunset. I don't like grown men who threaten to break a child's neck. Sunset!" "But, my lord, they're injured. He's only a peasant boy, and he was molesting Lord Pear's horse."
"I was only sitting on it," the boy burst out. "I was not what you said."
Matt nodded grimly.
"Boys don't get their necks broken for sitting on a horse, Padre. Not even peasant boys. You get these two gone, or I'll see about breaking their necks."
He motioned to Harnan, who nodded sharply to the other red arms. File leaders never did anything themselves, any more than Bannerman did, who snatched Pears and Coolin up roughly and hustled them away, groaning, with Padre trailing behind, wringing his hands and protesting that his masters were in no condition to ride, that they were hunters for the horn and heroes. Edorian still held the source of all this bother by an arm, Matt realized. The red arms were gone and the townsfolk drifting away. No one glanced twice at the boy. They had their own children to look after, and a hard enough time doing that. Matt exhaled heavily.
"Don't you realize you could be hurt just sitting on a strange horse, boy? A man like that probably rides a stallion that could trample a little boy into the bottom of his stall so no one could ever tell you were there. A gelding."
The boy gave another jerk at a Dorian's grip, and finding it had not loosened, put on a sulky face.
"It was a gelding, and it would not have hurt me.
horses like me. I am not a little boy. I am 9. And my name is Oliver, not boy.
Oliver, is it? 9? He might be. Matt had trouble telling, especially with Kyrianan children.
Well, Oliver, where are your mother and father?
He looked around, but the refugees he saw passed by as quickly as the townsfolk.
Where are they, Oliver? I have to get you back to them.
Instead of answering, Oliver bit his lip. A tear trickled from one eye, and he scrubbed it away angrily.
The Aiel killed my papa. One of those... Shado. Mama said we were going to Andor. She said we were going to live on a farm, with horses.
Where is she now? Matt asked softly.
She got sick. I buried her, where there were some flowers.
Suddenly Oliver kicked Dorian and began thrashing in his grip. Tears rolled down his face.
You let me go! I can take care of myself! You let me go!
Take care of him until we can find somebody, Matt told Dorian, who gaped at him in the middle of trying to fend the boy off and hold on to him at the same time.
Me? What am I to do with this leopard of a carpet mouse?
Get him a meal, for one thing. Matt's nose wrinkled. By the smell, Oliver had spent at least a little time on the floor of that gelding's stall. And a bath. He stinks.
You talk to me,
Oliver shouted, rubbing at his face. The tears helped him rearrange the dirt.
You talk to me, not over my head.
Matt blinked, then bent down. I'm sorry, Oliver. I always hated people doing that to me, too. Now this is how it is. You smell bad, so a Dorian here is going to take you to the Golden Stag, where Mistress Dalvin is going to let you have a bath. The sulkiness in Oliver's face grew. If she says anything, you tell her I said you could have one. She can't stop you. Matt held in a grin at the boy's sudden stare. That would have spoiled it. Oliver might not like the idea of a bath, but if someone might try to stop him from having one... Now, you do what a Dorian says. He's a real Tyran lord, and he's going to find you a good hot meal and some clothes without holes in them. And some shoes. Best not to add somebody to look after you. Mistress Dalvin could take care of that. A little gold would overcome any reluctance.
I do not like tyrants,
Oliver mumbled, frowning first at Dorian, then Matt. Dorian had his eyes shut and was muttering to himself.
He is a real lord? Are you a lord, too?
Before Matt could say anything, Estion came running through the crowd, lumpy face red and sweat-soaked. His dented breastplate retained few shreds of its former gilded glory, and the red satin stripes on his yellow coat sleeves were worn. He did not at all look like the son of the richest lord in Tyr. But then, he never had.
Matt!
He puffed, shoving fingers through lank hair that kept falling over his forehead.
Matt! Down at the river!
What? Matt cut in irritably. He was going to start having, I am not a bloody lord, embroidered on his coats.
Samael? The Shido? The Queen's Guards? The bloody white lions? What? A ship, Matt,
Estion panted, raking at his hair.
A big ship. I think it's the Sea Folk.
That was unlikely. The Athaon Mier never took their ships farther from open sea than the nearest port. Still, there were not very many villages along the Aranin to the south, and the supplies the wagons could carry were going to run thin before the band reached Tyr. He had already hired riverboats to trail along with the march, but a larger vessel would be more than useful. "Look after Oliver, Dorian," he said, ignoring the man's grimace. "Estion, show me this ship." Estion nodded eagerly and would have set out at a run again if Matt had not grabbed his sleeve to slow him to a walk. Estion was always eager, and he learned slowly. The combination was the reason he bore 5 bruises from Mistress Dalvin's cudgel. The numbers of refugees grew as Matt neared the river, both going down and coming back lethargically. Half a dozen broad-beamed ferries sat tied to the long tarred timber docks, but the oars had been carried away, and there was not a crewman in sight on any of them.
The only boats showing any activity were half a dozen river craft, stout 1- and 2-masted vessels that had put in briefly on their way upriver or down. The barefoot crewmen barely stirred on the boats Matt had hired. Their holds were full, and their captains assured him they could sail as soon as he gave the word. Ships moved on the Aranin, wallowing bluff-bowed craft with square sails and quick, narrow vessels with triangular sails, but nothing crossing between Meyron and Wald Arangil, where the white line of Andor flew. That banner had flown above Meyron, too, and the Andoran soldiers who held the town had not been willing to let the band of the Red Hand enter. Rand might hold Camelin, but his command did not extend to the Queen's Guards here, or the units that Gabriel had raised, like the White Lions. The White Lions were somewhere to the east now. They had fled in that direction, anyway. And any of a dozen rumors of brigands could have been their work. But the rest had crossed the river after sharp skirmishes with the band. Nothing had crossed the Aranin since. The only thing Matt really saw, though, was a ship anchored in the middle of the broad river. It really was a seafolk vessel, taller and longer than any of the river craft, but still sleek, with 2 raked masts. Dark figures climbed about in the rigging, some bare-chested in baggy breeches that looked black at the distance, some in bright-colored blouses marking the women. Half the crew would be women, near enough. The big square sails had been pulled up to the crossyards, yet they hung in slack folds, ready to be loosed in an instant. "Find me a boat," he told Estienne, "and some rowers." Estienne would need to be reminded of that. The Tyran blinked at him, raking at his hair. "Hurry, man!" Estienne nodded jerkily and lurched into a run. Walking down to the end of the nearest dock, Matt propped his spear on his shoulder and dug his looking-glass from his coat pocket. When he put the brass-bound tube to his eye, the ship leaped closer. The seafolk appeared to be waiting for something, but what? Some glanced toward Meyron, but most were staring the opposite way, including everyone on the tall quarter-deck. That would be where the sailmistress was, and the other ship's officers. He swung the looking-glass to the far side of the river, crossing a long, narrow rowboat with dark men at the oars racing toward the ship. There was something of a commotion on one of Arangil's long docks, nearly the twins of Meyron's. White-collared red coats and burnished breastplates denoted Queen's Guardsmen, plainly meeting a knot of arrivals from the ship. What made Matt whistle softly was the pair of fringed red parasols among the newcomers, one of 2 tiers. Sometimes those old memories came in handy. That 2-tiered parasol marked a clan wave mistress, the other her swordmaster. "I have a boat, Matt," Estienne announced breathlessly at his shoulder. "And some rowers." Matt turned the looking-glass back to the ship. By the activity on deck, they were hauling the small boat up on the other side, but already men at the capstan were hauling the anchor up, and the sails were being shaken out. "Looks like I won't need it," he muttered. On the other side of the river, the Atha An Mier delegation vanished up the dock with an escort of guardsmen. The whole thing made no sense. Seafolk 900 miles from the sea. Only the mistress of the ships outranked a wave mistress. Only the master of the blades outranked a sword master. No sense at all, not by any of those other men's memories. But they were old. He remembered that less was known of the Atha An Mier than of any people except the Aiel. He knew more of Aiel from his own experience than from those memories, and that little enough. Maybe somebody who knew the seafolk today could make top from bottom in it. Already sails billowed above the seafolk ship, with the anchor still being hauled dripping onto the foredeck. Whatever had them in such a hurry, it apparently would not take them back to the sea. With slowly increasing speed, the vessel glided upriver, curving toward the marsh-lined mouth of the Alguenia, a few miles north of Meyron. Well, it was nothing to do with him. With one last regretful look at the ship, the thing would have carried as much as all the smaller craft he had hired put together. Matt shoved the looking-glass back in his pocket and turned his back on the river. Estienne was still hovering, staring at him. "Tell the rowers they can go, Estienne.
Matt sighed, and the Tyran stumped away, muttering to himself and scrubbing his hands through his hair. More mud was visible than the last time he had come down to the river a few days ago. Just a sticky strip less than a hand wide between the water and the pace-deep band of cracked mud above, but proof even a river like the Aranin was slowly drying up. Nothing to do with him, nothing he could do about it anyway. He turned and headed back to his rounds of the taverns and common rooms. It was important that nothing seem out of the ordinary about today. When the sun went down, Matt was back in the Golden Stag, dancing with Betsy, minus her apron, while the musicians played as loudly as they could. Country dances this time, and tables pushed back to make room for six or eight couples. Dark brought a little coolness, but only by comparison with daylight. Everyone still sweated. Men laughing and drinking filled the benches, and the serving girls scurried to put mutton, turnips, and barley soup on the tables and keep ale mugs and wine cups full. Surprisingly, the women seemed to consider dancing a break from lugging trays about. At least every one of them smiled eagerly when it was her turn to dab perspiration from her face and doff her apron for a dance, though she sweated just as hard once it began. Maybe Mistress Delvin had worked out some sort of schedule. If she had, Betsy was an exception. That slender young woman fetched wine for no one but Matt, danced with no one but Matt, and the innkeeper beamed at them so much like a mother at her daughter's wedding that it made Matt uncomfortable. In fact, Betsy danced with him till his feet hurt and his calves ached, yet she never ceased smiling, her eyes shining with pure pleasure. Except when they stopped to catch breath, of course. For him to catch breath, she certainly showed no need. As soon as their feet halted, her tongue took off at a gallop. For that matter, it did the same whenever he tried to kiss her, and she always turned her head, exclaiming over something or other, so he kissed an ear or hair instead of lips. She always seemed startled by it, too. He could not figure out whether she was an utter featherhead or very clever. It was closer to 2 hours past midnight than one by the clock, when he finally told her he had had enough for one night. Disappointment crossed her face, and a small pout appeared. She looked ready to dance until dawn. She was not alone. One of the older serving women was leaning on one hand against a wall to massage a foot, but most of the others appeared bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as Betsy. The greater part of the men appeared to be wearing out, fixed smiles on those letting themselves be dragged away from their benches, and a good many just waving the women away. Matt did not understand. It must be because the man did most of the work in dancing, he decided, all the lifting and turning. And women were light. Leaping about simply took less energy for them. Blinking at a stout serving maid who was whirling Estion around the floor rather than the other way, the man could dance. He had that talent. Matt pressed a gold coin into Betsy's hand, a fat Andoran crown, for her to buy herself something pretty. She studied the coin for a moment, then lifted up on her toes to kiss him lightly on the mouth, like the brush of a feather.
"I would never hang you, whatever you did. You will dance with me tomorrow?"
Before he could answer, she giggled and darted away, eyeing him over her shoulder even when she started trying to pull a Dorian out to the dance area. Mistress Delvin interrupted the pair and, shoving an apron into Betsy's hands, jerked a thumb toward the kitchens. Matt limped slightly as he made his way to the table against the back wall, where Tomanus, Derrid, and Elysian had ensconced themselves. Tomanus was staring into his wine cup as if to find deep answers. A grinning Derrid was watching Nalisian try to fend off a plump serving maid with gray eyes and light brown hair, while not admitting that his feet were sore. Matt leaned his fists on the table. "The band moves south at first light. You best start making preparations." The three men gaped at him. "That is only a few hours," Tomanus protested at the same time that Nalisian said, "It will take that long just to root them out of the drinking rooms." Wincing, Derrid shook his head. "None of us will get any sleep tonight." "I will," Matt said. "One of you wake me in 2 hours. First light and we're marching." Which was how he found himself astride Pips, his sturdy brown gelding, in the gray pre-dawn, with his spear across his saddle and his unstrung longbow shoved beneath his saddle girth, with not enough sleep and an ache behind his eyes, watching the band of the Red Hand leave Meyrone. All 6,000 of them, half horse, half foot, and all making enough noise to rouse the dead. Despite the hour, people lined the streets and hung gawking from every upper window. The band's square red-fringed banner led the way, a red hand on white, the band's motto crimson embroidered below. Dove ande se tovias again. It's time to toss the dice. Nalician, Derrid, and Talmanis rode with the flag, 10 mounted men pounding away at brass kettle drums hung with scarlet skirting, and as many trumpeters adding flourishes. Behind came Nalician's horsemen, a mixture of Tyran armsmen and defenders of the stone, Carrion and lordlings with Khan on their backs and retainers at their heels, and a sprinkling of Andorans. Each squadron and troop with its own long banner bearing the red hand, a sword, and a number. Matt had had them draw lots for who got which number. The mixing had caused some grumbling. More than a little, truth to tell. In the beginning, Carrion and horse all followed Tomanis, and Tyran's Nalician. The foot had been a mongrel lot from the start. There had been mutters about making each unit the same size, too, and the numbers and the pennants. Lords and captains had always gathered as many men as would follow, who were known as Adorian's men, or Miracens, or Alhandrins. They still did some of that. For example, Adorian's 500 called themselves Adorian's Hammers, not the first squadron. But Matt had driven it into their heads that every man belonged to the band, not whatever land he had happened to be born in, and any who did not like doing things his way were free to leave. The remarkable thing was, none had. Why they stayed was hard to understand. Certainly they won when he led them, but some still died. He had a difficult time keeping them fed and seeing they got their pay more or less on time, and they might as well forget the wealth they boasted they were going to loot. Nobody had seen a coin of it so far, and he did not see much chance they ever would. It was madness. The first squadron raised a cheer quickly taken up by the fourth and fifth. Carloman's Leopards and Ryman's Eagles, they called themselves. Lord Matrim in victory! Lord Matrim in victory! If Matt had had a rock handy, he would have thrown it at them. The infantry came next in a flowing snake, each company behind a drum beating cadence as well as one of the long pennants, theirs with a pike instead of a sword across the hand. 20 ranks, bristling with pikes, followed by 5 of archers or crossbowmen. Each company had a flute or two as well, and they sang to the music. We drink all night and dance all day, and on the girls we spend our pay, and when we're done, then we'll away to dance with Jack of the Shadows. Matt waited out the song until the first of Tomanis's cavalry appeared, then dug his heels into Pips's flanks. No need to attend the supply wagons at the tail end, or the strings of remounts. Horses would go lame between here and Tyr, or die from things the farriers could not remedy, and a cavalryman without a horse was not worth much. On the river, 7 small ships crept downstream under triangular sails, little faster than the current. Each carried a small white flag with the red hand. Other craft were setting forth, too, some sprinting south under every scrap of canvas they could hold. As he caught up to the head of the column, the sun finally peaked above the horizon, sending the first rays across the rolling hills and scattered thickets. He pulled his hat low against the glare of the brilliant sliver. Nalician had a gauntleted fist to his mouth, stifling an impressive yawn, and Derrid sat slumped in his saddle, heavy-lidded, as if he might drift off to sleep right there. Only Talmanis was straight-backed, wide-eyed, and alert. Matt felt more in sympathy with Derrid. Even so, he raised his voice to be heard over the drums and trumpets. Put the scouts out as soon as we're beyond sight of the town. Both forest and open country lay farther south, but a fairly well-established road cut across both. Most traffic went by water, but enough had gone on foot or wagon over the years to mark out a track. And shut that bloody noise up. The scouts, Nalician said wonderingly. Burn my soul, there's no one with so much as a spear inside 10 miles of us. unless you think the White Lions have stopped running. And if they have, they won't come closer than 50 miles if they have any notion we're about.
Matt ignored him.
I want to make 35 miles today. When we can do 35 every day, we'll see how far we can push it.
They gaped at him, of course.
Horses could not maintain that pace very long, and anybody but Aiel considered 25 miles an excellent day's march for foot. But he had to play this out the way it had been dealt. Kamadrin wrote, "Attack on ground where your enemy believes you will not, from an unexpected direction and an unexpected time. Defend where your enemy believes you are not, and when he believes you will run. Surprise is the key to victory, and speed is the key to surprise. For the soldier, speed is life."
"Who is Kamadrin?" Tomanis asked after a moment, and Matt had to gather himself to answer.
"A general. Dead a long time. I read his book once."
He remembered reading it anyway, more than once. He doubted a copy existed anywhere now. For that matter, he remembered meeting Kamadrin, after losing a battle to him some 600 years before Arthur Hawkwing. Those memories did creep up on him. At least he had not delivered that little speech in the old tongue. He usually managed to avoid that sort of thing now.
Watching the mounted scouts fan out ahead across the rolling river plain, Matt relaxed. His part of it was begun, according to plan. A hasty departure on short notice, as if he were trying to sneak away south, but showy enough to make sure it was noticed. The combination would make him seem a fool, and that was good, too.
Teaching the band to move fast was a good idea. Moving fast could keep you away from the fighting. But their progress was sure to be noted from the river, if nowhere else. He scanned the sky. No ravens or crows, but that did not mean much. No pigeons, either. Yet if none had left Mehrone this morning, he would eat his saddle. In a few days, at most, Samael would learn the band was coming, hurrying, and the word Rand had put about down in Tyr would have made it clear that Matt's arrival would signal the imminent invasion of Ilion. At the best speed the band could do, it was still more than a month to Tyr. With any luck, Samael would be cracked like a louse between two rocks before Matt ever had to come within 100 miles of the man. Samael could see everything coming. Almost everything. But it was going to be a different dance than he expected. Different than anyone but Rand, Matt, and Bashir expected. That was the real plan. Matt actually found himself whistling. For once, everything was going to work out the way he expected.
Chapter 6. Threads Woven of Shadow. Cautiously, Samael stepped onto flowery silk carpets, leaving the gateway open in case he needed to retreat, and holding hard to Saidin. Usually he refused meetings except on neutral ground or his own, but this was the second time he had come here. A matter of necessity. He had never been a trusting man, and was less so since hearing bits of what had passed between Demandred and the three women, and Grendel certainly had told him only enough to support some gain she saw for herself. He quite understood. He had plans of his own the other Chosen knew nothing about. There would only be one Nablus, and that was a prize worth as much as immortality itself. He stood on a deep dais, marble-railed at one end, where tables and chairs of gilded work and carved ivory, some quite disgusting in their details, were arranged to command the rest of the long columned hall, 10 feet below. No stairs led down there. It was a huge, extravagant pit in which to present entertainment. Sunlight sparkled through tall windows, where colored glass made elaborate patterns. None of the sun's blistering heat penetrated. The air was cool, though he felt it only remotely. Grendel had no more need than he to make such an effort, but of course she would. The wonder was that she had not extended the net to the entire palace. There was something different in the lower part of the chamber since his last visit, but he could not see what. Three long wading pools ran down the center of the hall, each with a fountain, sleek forms, motion frozen in stone,
that sent water almost to the carved marble ribs of the arched ceiling overhead. Men and women sported in the pools, wearing scraps of silk or less, while others, garbed in little more, performed along the sides, acrobats and jugglers, dancers in varied styles, and musicians playing flutes and horns, drums, and all sorts of stringed instruments. Of every size, every shade of skin and hair and eyes, each was more physically perfect than the last. It was all meant to amuse whoever stood on the dais. It was idiocy, a waste of time and energy, typical of Grendel. The dais had been empty, except for himself, when he stepped onto it. But with Cydene filling him, he smelled Grendel's sweet perfume, like an air from a garden of flowers, and heard her slippers whispering on the carpets well before she spoke behind him. "Are my pets not beautiful?" She joined him at the railing, smiling at the display below. Her thin blue Damani gown clung and more than hinted. As usual, she had a ring with different stones on every finger, four or five gem-encrusted bracelets on each wrist, and a wide collar of huge sapphires snugged around the gown's high neck. He did not know about such things, but he suspected hours had gone into arranging those sun-gold curls touching her shoulders, and the moondrops seemingly scattered through them. There was something about their casualness that hinted at precision. Samael sometimes wondered about her. He had never met her until he chose to abandon a losing cause and follow the Great Lord. But everyone knew of her, famous and honored, a dedicated ascetic, treating those with disturbed minds, healing could not touch. At that first meeting, when she accepted his initial pledges to the Great Lord, every trace of the abstemious benefactor was gone, as if she had deliberately become the opposite of everything she had been before. On the surface, her total fixation was her own pleasure, nearly obscuring a desire to pull down everyone who had a particle of power. And that, in turn, almost hid her own thirst for power, very seldom exercised openly. Grendel had always been very good at hiding things in plain sight. He thought he knew her better than any of the other Chosen did. She had accompanied him to Sheol Ghul to make his obeisance. But even he did not know all the layers of her. She had as many shades as a jiggle had scales, slipping from one to another as quickly as lightning. She had been the mistress then, he the acolyte, for all his accomplishments as a general. That situation had changed. None of the waiters or performers looked up, but with her appearance they became more energetic, more graceful, if that was possible, attempting to display themselves to best advantage. They existed to please her. Grendel made sure of that. She gestured to four acrobats, a dark-haired man supporting three slim women, coppery skins oiled and gleaming.
"They are my favorites, I think. Ramzid is the Damani king's brother. The woman standing on his shoulders is Ramzid's wife. The other two are the king's youngest sister and eldest daughter. Don't you find it remarkable what can be learned with the proper encouragement? Consider all the talents going to waste."
That was one of her favorite concepts. A place for everyone, and everyone in their place, chosen for them according to their talents and the needs of society. Which needs always seemed to center on her own desires. The whole thing bored Samael. Had her precepts been applied to him, he would still stand where he was. The male acrobat turned slowly to give them a good view. He held a woman's straight arm to either side while they hung by one hand from the grip of the one on his shoulders. Grendel had already moved on to a very dark-skinned man and woman with curly hair, both of great beauty. The slender pair played oddly elongated harps with chimes that resonated to the plucked strings in crystalline echoes.
"My newest acquisitions from the lands beyond the Aiel Waste. They should thank me for rescuing them. Chiape was Shaboan, a sort of empress, newly widowed, and Shao Fan was to marry her and become Shabote. For 7 years she would have ruled absolutely, then died.
whereupon he would have chosen a new Sheboan, and ruled absolutely until his death in 7 years. They have followed that cycle for nearly 3,000 years without a break. She gave a small laugh and shook her head wonderingly. Xiaofan and Chiappe insist the deaths are natural. The will of the pattern, they call it. To them, everything is the will of the pattern.
Samael kept his eyes on the people below. Grendel prattled like a fool, but only a true fool took her for one. What she seemed to let slip among her babbling was often planted as carefully as a kanji needle. The key was picking out why and what she meant to gain. Why would she suddenly have snatched pets from so far away? She seldom went out of her way. Was she trying to divert him toward the lands beyond the waste by making him think she had an interest there? The battlefield was here. The great lord's first touch, when he broke free, would land here. The rest of the world would be whipped by the fringes of storms, even racked by storms, but those storms would generate here. "Since so much of the Damani King's family met with your approval," he said dryly, "I am surprised no more did." If she wanted to divert him, she would find a way to slide it in again. She never thought anyone knew her tricks well enough to see through them. A lithe, dark-haired woman, not young, but with the sort of pale beauty and elegance that would last all her life, appeared at his elbow, cradling a crystal goblet of dark wine punch in both hands. He took it, though he had no intention of drinking. Beginners watched for a major assault till their eyes burned, and let a lone assassin walk up behind them. Alliances, however temporary, were all very well, but the fewer of the chosen who remained on the day of the return, the greater the chance among the survivors to be named Nablus. The great lord had always encouraged such competition. Only the fittest were worthy to serve. At times, Samael believed that the one chosen to rule the world forever would be the last of the chosen left standing. The woman turned back to a muscular young man who held a golden tray with another goblet and a tall matching pitcher. Both wore diaphanous white robes, and neither gave so much as the flicker of an eye to the gateway opening into his apartments in Ilion. When she served Grendel, the woman's face was a portrait of worship. There was never any trouble about speaking in front of her servants and pets, though they would not number a single friend of the dark among them. She distrusted friends of the dark, claiming they were too easily swayed, but the level of compulsion used on those who served her personally left little room for anything beyond adoration. "I almost expect to see the king himself here serving wine," he continued.
"You know I choose only the most exquisite. Al-Salam is not up to my standard."
Grendel took the wine from the woman with barely a glance, and not for the first time Samael wondered whether the pets were another screen, like the chattering. A little prodding might shake something loose.
"Sooner or later you will slip, Grendel. One of your visitors will recognize one who serves him wine or turns down his bed, and he will have sense enough to hold his tongue until he leaves. What will you do if someone descends on this palace with an army to rescue a husband or a sister? An arrow may not be a shock lance, yet it can still kill you."
She threw back her head and laughed, a trill of gay amusement, plainly too silly to see the implied insult. "Plainly, as long as you did not know her."
"Oh, Samael, why would I let them see anything but what I want them to? I certainly do not send my pets to serve them. Al-Salam's supporters and his opponents, even the dragon sworn, leave here thinking I support them, and only them. And they do not want to disturb an invalid."
His skin tingled slightly as she channeled, and for an instant her image changed. Her skin became coppery, but dull. Her hair and eyes dark, but flat. She appeared gaunt and frail, a once beautiful Damani woman slowly losing a battle against illness. He barely stopped his lip from curling. One touch would prove the angular contours of that face were not hers. Only the most subtle use of illusion could pass that test. But Grendel seemed wedded to flamboyance. The next moment she was herself again, wearing a wry smile.
"You would not believe how they all trust and listen to me."
It never ceased to amaze him that she chose to remain here in a palace well known across Ardaman, with civil war and anarchy all around her. Of course, he did not think she let any others of the Chosen know where she had established herself. That she trusted him with the knowledge made him wary. She liked her comforts, and never wanted to expend much effort to keep them. Yet this palace was in sight of the Mountains of Mist, and considerable work was necessary to keep the turmoil away from her. To keep anyone from asking where the former owner had gone, along with his family and servants. Samael would not be surprised if every Domani who visited here left believing that this